You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Manuel toko ingoa, nau mai, hari mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I am your host, Manny, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I am also joined by producers Toby and Theo. Ewhai akanei, coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the two Green Party's members' bills that were drawn, and concerns corporate lobbying at the highest levels may be undermining our core democratic processes. And Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Miles Thomas, trustee and founder of the Better Public Media Trust, on their petition calling for the strengthening of the Broadcasting Standards Authority, instead of the government's plan to disestablish the authority. I also spoke to Dr. Justin Nan, a plant protection scientist at Scion and the New Zealand Institute for Bioeconomy Science, about the government's recent funding boost for wilding pine control.
And Toby, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to US history expert Paul Tayon about the Trump administration's stance on Cuba and the possibility of military action.
He aha o whakaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Koua e wareware, e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki anei kororo anō. Hei pakehiri, rukiruki maronga e te pai. Tuku tuku e rangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Two Green Party's members' bills were drawn recently. The first would ban mining on conservation land. It comes at a time when parties in the government coalition seem to have their hearts set on turbocharging the mining industry, with a key bill being put forward that would enable a range of new commercial activities on conservation land and potentially allow the sale of over 60% of it. The other Green Party bill would tie social service agencies together with a shared responsibility to protect children leaving care in Oranga Tamariki from finding themselves without a place to live. And finally, a landmark climate lawsuit against six key companies was stopped in its tracks when the government put through legislation changing the ability to sue. The government says that it made the decision to ensure businesses had legal clarity and certainty. However, it has been revealed that the government and businesses had been in contact, and knowledge of this contact may have been unduly withheld, prompting critics to raise the alarm that the government may be circumventing core democratic processes to satisfy business interests. And so for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about their party's members' bills, especially the mining and conservation land, and also what it means for the government to intervene in such a way as in this case. Well, kia ora, welcome to the show, Ricardo.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
I want to start our conversation today by talking about the two Greens bills that have been drawn from the biscuit tin.
Yes.
Let's start with the first one, the bill that would ban mining and conservation land. It's a big moment with mining and conservation land. It comes around as a bit of a perennial issue, but it's back again. Some people are pushing to allow it, and some people are also pushing just to sell the conservation land too. What would this bill achieve?
Well, basically, the notion is that conservation land should be for all of us. And it's there to protect native species, wildlife, and the places that we all love and actually make our country unique. We've long said that conservation estates should not be dug up for private profit, because basically we lose that for generations to come. There's already restrictions placed on like a lot of commercial activities in there, and somehow mining is now just getting a special pass. So this is just simply closing a loophole where mining should not be treated differently to every other commercial activity. And the additional stuff that we would be doing as well is to basically ensure that any new mining permits would have to be surrendered if protected wildlife species are discovered within the permit area. And the notion, again, is that we can actually have an economy that works for all of us, where there's more jobs, where there's more opportunities, but that doesn't have to come at the expense of our natural environment. And a lot of the mining proposals the government is putting forward does exactly that. Short-term profits that get taken offshore, not many jobs being created through it, and there's better alternative economic development options for our country.
With the ceding of the mining licenses with endangered species, is this on land that is not conservation land? This is on other land?
My understanding is that it's broader, but I think this is why it's important to also ensure that any mining permit is not putting endangered species at risk. And because, again, the short-term profits will create the conditions for irreversible damage to our biodiversity, to our natural environment. And again, as I said, this isn't about whether we have economic development or not. This is just simply saying that there cannot be an economy with a completely wrecked environment, that there are better alternative sectors that we should be developing that are far more sustainable, do not cause as much harm to the economy. We've put out a plan in the Green Budget over, for example, how we can boost our manufacturing sector so that, for example, we process the wood that we produce here for construction materials. There are other places where the economy could be growing, could be developing. Mining and conservation land just simply isn't.
In the RNZ article that was covering this piece of legislation, they had someone from the Aggregate and Quarry Association asking questions around things that were already being mined on conservation land, such as, let me pull it up and get it right.
I think I've seen the article, and I think it was about sort of quarries for things like rail infrastructure, roads, and tourism.
I think we're maintaining tramping tracks as well within tramping. Part of this, what they emphasized was that we get some amount of a ponamu through this industry as well.
I think this is why we have the select committee stage with any bill, particularly members' bills. And so my ask for political parties is that they support this bill to get it to select committee so that we can unpack all of that. That is exactly what the select committee process is for, is to go and say, well, okay, look, there may be already some permits there. This is what we're doing. Do we need to explore any potential sort of unintended consequences? But I think on the whole, most New Zealanders would agree that conservation land is there for everyone and it shouldn't be for short-term profits. If there are industries that can make a good claim about long-term benefits and how they're mitigating the harm to our environment in a way that is genuinely evidence-based, they can come to the select committee and present.
At this point in time, does it look like this bill is going to get through its first reading?
Well, to be honest, that depends on the government scheduling their next member states. There's probably only a handful before the end of the term, but it could well be the case that we're able to have the first reading before the end of the term, that the government schedules another member state.
And just before we move on to the next bill, I just want to ask a question that seems pertinent to ask at this time, when there was also a bill that was put forward by the government that was looking at maybe selling a lot of our conservation land. If we are protecting the conservation land that we have, but we also then sell 2/3 of it, what protections is this really affording to our land?
The bill isn't intended to fix that part of the government's agenda, right? And of course, we shouldn't just be selling conservation land to the highest bidder. That's not right. I think, though, what we also need is better protections for the conservation land that we have at the moment, from extractive mining companies that put short-term profits over long-term economic benefits. And so, again, we shouldn't, of course, be selling conservation land just like that, but this bill intends to simply fix a loophole that exists.
All right, let's move on to the second bill, and we have to spend a bit less time on this one, unfortunately. But it is to ensure young people aren't made homeless when leaving Oranga Tamariki. Could you give us a bit of an explanation on what the situation that this bill is trying to address is?
Yeah, so basically, and having worked at the front lines before being an MP, like, I've seen how agencies end up not working well together to support people who either, for example, come out of state care or even prison to ensure that they have a safe, stable home to go into. This is critical to ensuring the stability and well-being of young people. So basically, this bill would require Oranga Tamariki to be able to arrange suitable accommodation. So this could look like, for example, working with Work and Income on this and to actually be satisfied that they're being put into a stable and safe home. And so this comes off the back of the 2025 Homelessness Insight Report, and where it found that young people leaving care and custody were struggling to find appropriate housing, but also frontline service community groups have been telling us this for quite some time. I saw it myself when I worked at the front lines, and this is something that young people have told us, that they're basically released from state care and then basically being told to fend for themselves, despite the reason for being in state care was that they needed support to begin with. It's not like those needs and that trauma just magically disappear the moment that you exit state care.
All right, I want to move on to our final topic this morning. The Green Party put out a statement that was raising concerns about New Zealand democracy and corporate corruption in relation to allegations that the Prime Minister's office withheld information around deals and lobbying by major climate polluters ahead of legislation that would change tort law. Maybe I'll let you explain it if you have a better understanding of it than I do. What's going on here?
Yeah, so basically, there was media reporting that previously there was undisclosed briefing documents sent to the Prime Minister's office by Fonterra and Z Energy. And these are two huge corporations that were engaging basically in lobbying. The issue that we have here is that then the Prime Minister's office claimed there was no record of documents that came to light on this meeting, no records of the meeting. And we do know that a lot of what they were asking for then ended up turning into government legislation, which negatively impacts our ability to deal with climate change. And so this is why we've long been pushing for an independent inquiry into the handling of those documents, because one of the issues that we've long had is their ability for corporations to effectively lobby government to turn their wishes into law, which again may put short-term profits ahead of the long-term benefits. I mean, we saw this, for example, with the case of Uber, where they basically, the documents that came out of the government were very much mirroring the talking points from Uber Corporation, and that ended up undermining the rights of Uber drivers. And now we're seeing it on climate laws when it comes to lobbying by Fonterra and State Energy. And so this is why we've support the fact that, you know, as of yesterday, we're aware that the Ombudsman is opening an investigation into the handling of these documents. And I think the Prime Minister should welcome them, because if he is so sure that there was no mishandling of the documents, that we're not just basically copy-pasting corporate speaking lines and turn them into law, then he has nothing to worry about in relationship to the inquiry.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much for joining me this morning, Ricardo.
Thank you, Emmanuel. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Ka kite.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March about two of the Green Party's members' bills, as well as corporate lobbying, now in front of the Ombudsman.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
This is Friday Night at the Liquor Store by Avondale Bowling Club. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Friday Night at the Liquor Store.
Yeah, the water hole at the shithole, the whole neighborhood lined up like prey in the Sahara. Dismount from truck cab and stampede the pool of Steinlager like a school of piranha. Box under armor, still under the armor. Young cub under the table watching his father. Red lions, great geese, purple iguanas, all running like mascara the day after. Still trying to chase a dragon they'll never catch. Bitch of an itch of which you'll never scratch with a scratchy. Blow a whole bag on a baggie. Bottle up a problem in a bottle of happy. In the high-vis tux at the broke folks ball. Steel cap tapped on some bourbon soaked floor. Piss poor looking for more piss to pour.
Friday night at the liquor store.
Fuck you looking at? White walkers, Johnny walkers, could have been Stan walkers. Olympic level shit talkers. The best of West Auckland's worst combined forces of workhorses horsed on state house porches. Gather like mourners to farewell the fallen dreams of old washed up fiends and broke ballers. 44-year-old George warehouse foreman knocked out front lawn Sunday morning. Synchronized drowning. Friday night out like it's Thursday night, housing and overpriced housing. Staring at the AirPods machine like I'm waiting for the lotto numbers.
All the cancer results.
Ding, 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 you just wanna jack shit jackpot. Chip a cap off, the tooth bite and the cap off. What you really know about conditioning, Pavlov? The fuck you looking at? You got an eye problem. And what?
The fuck you
something for a side thing. Hey, this can't stand in the dirt. This can't stand in the dirt. Sorry, boss. Hey, but can I just get these 24 credits thing? Hey, fuck it, they turn the network in.
Yes, it's a 12-hour day, 60-hour week, and it's a Friday night.
At the liquor store. Yeah.
Friday night at the liquor store, automatic door like a wormhole to a holding cell. Low enough to dig a hole to hell, bottom of the well, I know it well. If I had a soul, the seller would have pawned it. Too bad the man's back in rehab, he might have been clean if he could afford it. You can lead a horse to water, but he'll still horse it. What's the real reason it caused it? Can't call it, out of credit. Friday night, you know where I'm headed, walking 12 blocks through the desert just to get it on the Benny like Paula Bennett. Lord and peasant, landlord and tenant, same scam. Fell in love with the same man that killed our parents, the same spirits, the broke girls got hearings, and I just got paid. You can't tell me that I ain't rich. Friday night at the liquor store, swarms of locusts, packs of smokes and boats of bogans. The voodoo man sending the hope to the hopeless, the most broke, half rich, almost homeless. Rush like roaches in the light before it closes, and some of us will be right back before he opens. Lie around the corner in the middle of COVID, and we're still out here vortexing coronas. Hang around like vultures over the carcass, scavengers in Michael Savage's garden. Packs of rats and drunk fatherless bosses with one life to live in two car garages. Playing lost card with a hand of lost chances, trauma like a hospital pass, pass on the casket. Everlasting paradise and never lost it. Whole life chasing the past, never got past it. It's Friday night at the liquor store. You got a Dolliver?
Is there a train to the Rocky Mountains? Is there a place where we can dance? I want a tent to sell some buttons. I want a sound man to make a sound sound so loud. I'm gonna cut my nails before I go. I'm gonna cut my hair and get really scared. Cut my nails before I go. I'm gonna cut my hair and get really scared.
If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates.
I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums and more.
Oh, my favourite jazz solo of all time. You know that one that's like boop it
barrel barrel.
Now, I feel like they definitely improvise
like you guys still talking about jazz?
Yeah, just trying to work it out, man.
Do you know Grover?
Washington, Grover Washington, Limelight, great album.
Grover from the Muppets.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I guess so.
Does he like jazz?
All kinds of people love jazz. The 95BFM Jazz Show. Sundays at 12 with Blind Mango Chutney, Def Jim, Miss Dom, Francis Chan, or Dr. Mark Baines. The 95BFM Jazz Show. 12 till 2 p.m. Sundays, thanks to San Ray.
Hello, Ms. Toucan. Morena, Mr. Sloth, Mrs. Sloth. And how are you, Mr. Big, Scary, Ferocious Lion?
You never know what you'll find on the BFM Kids Show, bringing stories, songs, games, and all kinds of fun to your Sunday morning since forever ago. The 95 BFM Kids Show, 7 to 9 every Sunday morning on BFM.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
That is the result of His Majesty's government.
You're listening to The Wire.
For over two centuries, political leaders in the United States of America have been fixated on the idea of bringing the island nation of Cuba into the American sphere of influence. Now, under the leadership of Donald Trump, direct military intervention in Cuba seems more likely than it has since the early 60s. The former Cuban president Raul Castro has recently been indicted by a grand jury in Miami, leading to a speculation that the Trump administration may use the same strategy deployed in the indictment and subsequent abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. To discuss the history of U.S.-Cuba relations and the prospects of military intervention by Trump, I spoke to U.S. history expert Dr. Paul Tayon. Lately, we've heard Secretary of State Marco Rubio describe Cuba as a national security threat. We've also heard Donald Trump claim that he will be the first president in 70 years to take action against Cuba and put an end to that threat once and for all, strongly hinting at a military takeover. Now, this obsession with bringing Cuba into the American sphere of influence has a long history. Over two centuries ago, in 1820, Thomas Jefferson said that the island was, quote, the most interesting addition which could ever be made to our system of states. So as a historian, could you give us a sense of why Cuba has loomed so large for so long in the American geopolitical imagination? And to what extent are these national security concerns actually warranted?
Cuba has figured in the American imagination, you're absolutely correct, for since the early 19th century. And as a historian, I would say the best way to understand that place of Cuba in the American vision is understandable in terms of the way in which American leaders, and indeed many Americans from the very beginning of the American Republic, conceived of their new nation as a rising empire. And I use that term very specifically to mean an empire, as Thomas Jefferson put it, as an empire of liberty, that is a democratic republic expanding across the North American continent. So American leaders assumed and worked to make that happen. Now, by the second decade of the 19th century, such figures as Jefferson himself, as you mentioned, but also the Secretary of State under President James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, also envisioned American influence extending beyond the continental United States to Central America, the Caribbean, the Western Hemisphere. And of course, the Monroe Doctrine, which John Quincy Adams, as Secretary of State, authored, stood as that declaration of American hemispheric dominance, or at least an aspiration to that role in the Americas. Cuba figured as one, as perhaps the one of the key island nations in the projection of U.S. power across the Caribbean and across Latin America. And I could say more about that history, And the bee in the bonnet that many Americans and American leaders have had about Cuba from the 19th century all up into the present. But to skip straight to the present and Rubio's assertions of Cuba as a security threat must be taken within the context of that longer-term American fixation on Cuba as having to fall under American influence, if not control. And so the exact nature of the security threat is curious, given that Rubio has suggested that Cuba serves as a point of projection of power for Russia and China. Given the blockade on Cuba, it's rather hard to see just what is the nature of that security threat and the fact that Cuba has been struggling in many ways since the end of the Cold War in the loss of its patron in the Soviet Union on the one hand, and on the other, well, it's the overwhelming military capacity of the United States.
I mean, that argument that you mentioned of Cuba as a kind of staging post for Russia, I mean, that made sense back in 1962, but times have changed, right?
Correct. And as you're referring to, Toby, the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, where the Soviet Union, with Cuban government's approval, built missile launching sites in the north shore of Cuba, about 90 miles away from the U.S. mainland. And that stood a clear security threat. And that then led to the missile crisis, where the world stood probably as close as it ever has to all-out nuclear war. Fortunately, President John Kennedy and Premier Nikita Khrushchev negotiated that the removal of Soviet missiles. At the same time, it's worth noting that part of that deal secretly was the removal of U.S. missiles from Turkey within striking distance of the Soviet Union. Though today the most that Cuba seems to be able to mount, which is not to be discounted, would be drones, which could be used to attack the United States, much in the way that Ukraine has used drones very effectively against Russia. And that goes to a side comment I'll say here, and that the U.S. war in Iran and the Russian war in Ukraine have some commonality in that they are asymmetrical, and that these heavy military powers are finding themselves suddenly struggling to cope with asymmetrical warfare using drones. All that said and done, it's hard for me to imagine that Cuba would launch drone attacks against the United States, knowing the weight of a possible U.S. military response and intervention.
Recently, Marco Rubio delivered a video address to the Cuban people in Spanish, promising to build a better future with American help. And for the first Latino Secretary of State, taking action in Cuba has a degree of personal significance. According to Rubio's telling of his family history, his parents left Cuba in the 50s and decided they couldn't return after the country's shift to communism. There's a fairly large demographic of Cuban Americans, especially in the state of Florida, with very similar life stories. So how do Cuban Americans view the communist government today, and how did they fit into the wider political landscape of the United States?
Great question. Starting with Rubio himself, he is the first Cuban-American Secretary of State. He is actually the first Cuban-American to occupy such a position of influence within the U.S. government. That said, it's also curious. It's interesting to note that in the formulation and implementation of U.S. foreign policy, Rubio has been all but frozen out of everything except with the Americas. That said, this has been Rubio's longstanding life ambition to effect regime change in Cuba. And that is understandable, and I would suggest, in the first instance, in the longer-term U.S. relationship with Cuba, which dates from the Monroe Doctrine, runs through the War of 1898, and U.S. pattern of intervention in the Caribbean Basin across the 20th century, and more immediately in terms of the hatred of families like Rubio's and Cuban expats. I call them anti-Castro emigres who left Cuba in the aftermath of the Cuban Revolution of 1959 and have maintained a conservative, anti-communist, anti-Cuban political community in the United States, heavily centered in Florida since the 1960s. And indeed, this community has made itself an influence within the Republican Party. Rubio now stands to possibly achieve a life's goal. And in this regard, I can't help but understand this policy as very personal for Rubio.
Last month, a grand jury in Miami indicted Raul Castro, the 94-year-old brother of Fidel. After taking over from his brother, Raul led Cuba as president from 2008 to 2018. He's now being charged with murder based on his connection to an incident in 1996 in which four Cuban-American anti-communist activists flying small planes over the country were shot down by the Cuban Air Force. So what is the logic of charging a 94-year-old former president with murder?
This is very interesting. The event to which you refer was an attempt on the part of, again, these Cuban anti-Castro emigres, activists flying planes over Cuba, as I understand it, to drop propaganda leaflets. They were shot down, and this is disputed, just outside or just inside the Cuban international boundary in terms of airspace, without any warning. And this, though, must be understood in the context of repeated overflights of Cuba before the incident in question. And so this indictment stands alongside the actions of the Trump administration in Venezuela, of course, with Maduro. And it begs logic in terms of sovereignty, the indicting of Raul Castro in a U.S. criminal court. But as to the why of this, there's multiple ways of thinking of it. As President Miguel Díaz-Canel has suggested, it's a political maneuver designed to set the pretext, along with Cuba as a foreign security threat, for intervention in Cuba, on the one hand. On the other hand, it could be a sideshow to take attention off the failing U.S. war in Iran. Or, and this is how I like to see it, as compared with U.S. interventions in Central America across the 19th and 20th century, which have been justified in the language of liberal internationalism, that is, we stand to spread democracy and the benefits of the American way through trade and government. In this case, despite Rubio's rhetoric, I see this really much more as Donald Trump as a gang boss muscling the competition off his turf. That is how I understand U.S. policy towards Venezuela, and that's how I make sense of U.S. policy towards Cuba. And indeed, that helps me to understand the Trump regime writ large. It's also worth noting that in this Trump government, Trump is a figurehead, but who is actually running the policy in this case? Rubio has carved out for himself and managed to pursue his own agenda, which happens to dovetail with that of Trump.
That was Dr. Paul Theon, senior history lecturer specializing in U.S. history at the University of Auckland.
This is Venus in the Zinnia by Aldous Harding. We'll be right back after the short break.
Not the same, it's too late, you're right on time. I feel the sea, dishonest heart in me, blood in my nose, sin to say.
Right. That was Venus in the Zinnia by Aldous Harding, featuring H. Hawkline. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. These are words that you may be hearing much more or much less on 95BFM after the government announced earlier this month that it will be scrapping the Broadcasting Standards Authority, or BSA. The authority has responsibility over the broadcast of radio and television, but has long called for regulatory changes to be made given the shift toward digital media. The issue reached prominence last year when the BSA decided to hear a complaint about the digital media company, The Platform. The move was met with severe criticisms from the government, with the ACT Party and New Zealand First in particular calling for the abolishing of the authority. In its place, the government has proposed the Media Council, a voluntary body, will be involved in self-regulation of the media. However, this proposal has been widely criticised as lacking regulatory teeth. Instead of scrapping the BSA, the Better Public Media Trust has proposed that the government strengthens it with the recommendations from the government's Safer Online Services Research Project, which would see greater regulation of online and digital spaces. So, for this week's Get Action, I spoke with the Better Public Media Trust's Miles Thomas to discuss their petition to reinstate and strengthen the BSA. Kia ora, Miles. So it seems like there is some common ground between the position of the Better Public Trust and that of the government in that the BSA, as it currently stands, is not fit for purpose. However, your organisation is calling for the BSA to be strengthened for the digital world. The government instead wants the BSA to be replaced by self-regulation of the industry through the Media Council. So what's wrong with that latter approach?
Well, the problem with that is that it doesn't have any teeth, you could say. So the Media Council is an industry, voluntary industry body, so that membership is voluntary. You don't have to be a member of the Media Council. And in fact, the Platform, Reality Check Radio, are not members of the Media Council. And so they don't actually, so none of their output, media output, whether it's the stuff they broadcast or the podcast, are actually under the jurisdiction of the Media Council. So that's one problem, is it doesn't, that it's voluntary. The other problem is that if you get a rogue media organisation that decides that the Media Council decision, they don't like it, the Media Council might say ask them to make an apology for something they've done wrong. So for example, being racist on air or something like that. The Media Council can't do anything more. They can ask them to say sorry, and that's it. And there's no way of forcing them to do that. Whereas the BSA has the statutory power, which means it's legislated by the government to actually then force that media organisation that's maybe, like say TVNZ, maybe produces some sort of racist content. It can force TVNZ to make an apology. If TVNZ doesn't make an apology, they can force TVNZ to be non-commercial for 24 hours. And if that doesn't happen, then they can go even further. So the BSA has a way of forcing rogue media organisations to toe the line and be legal and be ethical and be responsible. And that's really important. And we see over in, if that doesn't happen, for example, in the USA, where they don't have this stronger media regulation, you see what's happened. They've got media that is absolutely, utterly unbalanced and irresponsible. You've got podcasters who just absolutely do the worst misinformation available. For example, Alex Jones and hundreds and thousands of media, online media types like him. And that's what happens. And that's what will happen in New Zealand if we lose the BSA. Slowly, not instantly, but there'll be a slow deterioration of our media to the point where it's just crazy. Like you get in the USA, and that has an impact, of course, on our politics and on our culture as well. So it's actually really important.
Currently, the Media Council is responsible for regulating print media. Do we see those kinds of issues there currently, or is it not really a comparison you can make?
The Media Council is pretty good in terms of they have a reputation, and the most of the mainstream newspapers, all the mainstream newspapers take it seriously, and they don't want to be, they don't want to come under the wrath of the Media Council. They're not the problem. The problem is the rogue, small-time crazies, a bit like you might get with on the platform or reality check radio, who don't care. In fact, they, and this is what's happened in the USA, the part of their business model is being crazy and mad and saying just crazy stuff that gets people's attention and is slightly entertaining and also appeals to their gut reaction and reactionary, and maybe they're anti-vax, so it appeals to that, appeals to the bubble that they're in. And so it's those media operators who are much more of a problem. And currently the Media Council can't do anything about them. But, yeah, sure, the mainstream newspapers like NZME stuff, and magazines, and also some of the websites are all part of Media Council as well, and they all tend to be responsible, and so that's good. But it's the ones who don't, that's the problem.
Right, so the solution that the Better Public Media Trust has kind of put forward is the government adopting the Safer Online Services Research Project, and having the BSA into that kind of digital realm of regulation. Now, it's relatively easy to think how, you know, that might apply to digital broadcasts. So, like, for example, shows that pretty strongly resemble traditional broadcast media, except they're on the internet. But would this regulatory approach apply to things like social media posts or pages or comments or things like that?
Yeah, well, that's a really tricky thing, and that was probably the toughest question that they would face. That they faced when coming up with that research was how to control social media. And it's an ongoing problem around the world. Whether to control it, first of all, and then how. You know, there are very powerful organisations now, very wealthy, and they also have, they're really only controlled by the US government, and the US government goes into bat for them if other countries try and control them. So, you know, and but in Europe, and Australia now and Canada are trying to put regulations around social media companies and what they, basically that they have to pay taxes, because a lot of them don't pay any tax whatsoever, but also to somehow control what they publish. Because, you know, for a few decades ago, it was decided that social media organisations are not publishers. They're like the news agent, rather than the publisher of the magazine. So they're not responsible for what people say on their platform. And that's a big problem, because it means that if anyone is the victim of what people say, they've got no one they can go and say, hey, you can't do this. They can't go and sue Facebook, for example, because Facebook says, well, it's not us, we didn't publish it, we're not responsible for this. And so that's a big change that needs to be made, is that we need to somehow find a way to make social media responsible. And I think the SOS, the Safer Online Services research followed some examples, some systems are brought in Australia and the UK, whereby those organisations, first of all, they have a voluntary code that they stick to. If anyone is unhappy with it, they complain to the voluntary code organisation. So that'll be representatives from Meta and Twitter and X and whatever else is on that. And if those organisations don't pull down the content and stop it reappearing, then there's another step that will have teeth, a bit like the BSA. That's a tougher thing, because, you know, New Zealand government, how would they, you know, they're nervous about constricting social media, especially with Donald Trump as president, and he would go into bat against any plans to curb social media. So it's tricky, but, you know, there was a solution there, and it's definitely going to be better. It's necessary, because social media, I mean, yeah, freedom of speech and all that stuff, but not freedom to harm others.
Right, yeah, and I think one of the proposals put forward in that document was that the companies would come together within a certain industry, whether that's video games or social media or what have you, and they'd work with a regulator to come up with those kind of codes of conduct, and the regulator would be responsible for kind of interacting with them. They would have to police their own users. Now, that would probably necessitate increased collection of data on people to, for example, distinguish between someone who might be using a slur in hate speech or someone who is perhaps part of that community and is reclaiming that. Now, if we hold these big tech companies responsible for policing these kind of this kind of speech, would that run the risk of greater breaches of privacy and the kind of data that they would be collecting on their users to kind of have those nuances respected?
That's a really interesting question, isn't it? We have to decide what's more important. What's more important is it stopping hate speech, or is it allowing that data to be collected? It's already collected anyway through, you know, just by looking at what we tap on, because it goes to our news feeds. So they do really already collect it and use it for commercial purposes. No harm in using it for safety of online for online safety purposes, in my view. But you know, the other thing is, would they actually need to collect that information? That's a fine line, really. They already have to. Like, for example, photographs of nudity, right? So there was that classic case of that horrible photograph from the Vietnam War of a person being shot and they were naked. And that was deemed to be, the algorithm thought it was porn, I think it was, or something like that, and so it took it off for that reason. And so that's already happening, you know? It's already, algorithms are already trying to differentiate between when something is harmful and when it's not. So, you know, we can't get away from that happening anyway.
Finally, I just want to kind of end with, the big point of your proposed reforms of the BSA. Now, the alternative that the government's given forward, you've mentioned, has no teeth. What would the teeth be that you would give to the BSA under this kind of reformation and strengthening?
Well, we've asked for the BSA to be strengthened, but it actually really what would be a better solution is for the Safer Online Services proposal to be legislated and created, so that it's kind of like the BSA. It's kind of an amalgam, if you like, of the Media Council. It's a first step, a voluntary code that they abide by, and then the BSA backs it up. And currently the BSA only regulates broadcast, so radio and TV essentially. So it would be strengthening, spreading that out, that statutory protection across all media. So it would include newspapers, online websites, podcasts, and social media.
That was Miles Thomas, trustee and founder of the Better Public Media Trust, on their petition calling for the strengthening of the Broadcasting Standards Authority instead of the government's plan to disestablish the authority. If you'd like to sign their petition, you can find it on the Our Action Station website or through the link we'll include in the description of this interview on our BCast page.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
Wilding pines are an ongoing issue for ecosystems across Aotearoa. The ubiquitous conifers crowd out native plant life, taking up water and nutrients that would otherwise be used to support native ecosystems. The pines also present a fire risk and shrink the available grazing land of farms. They spread easily and rapidly, requiring intensive eradication efforts to both remove the pines from a region and ensure that they do not return. Now, earlier this week, the government announced a boost to wilding pine control funding of an additional $79 million over the next 3 years, bringing the total spend to $109 million. So, to discuss the war on Christmas trees and the destruction these pines wreak on our ecosystems, I spoke to Dr. Justin Nairn, a plant protection scientist at Scion and the New Zealand Institute for Bioeconomy Science. Kia ora, Justin. So the government has announced that funding for wilding pine control efforts is going to more than double under a budget 2026 boost. So starting off, I guess, what is the issue with wilding pines?
It's quite a major issue for New Zealand. And basically, you have these pines that are deciding, or conifers. There's a couple of species that were planted a number of years ago, and the industries phased them out, but they're still present in the environment, either as original wilding trees, or potentially they'll be planted into shelter belts, or regrowing from the original forests that were planted. At one stage, the government was using pines to stabilise ground and deliberately seeding pines because they recognised that they established well and grew well in our environment, and then later subsequently realised how much of a problem they were becoming. I was aware as a researcher that this was a problem, and we were working on solutions and herbicides to effectively treat them. In a recent conference that I went down to the South Island, I was absolutely blown away by the scale of the problem. And you'll drive past what looks to be a planted forest, and it is all wilding pine just expanding across the landscape. And some of the wilding species, or some of the species, are much more prone. They're very good feeders and very good, the seed can spread a long way. The primary forestry pine tree that we have at the moment is radiata pine, and that isn't a very good spreader, so any wilding tends to be establishing in the location that they're planted in the forest anyway, and they're not really creeping beyond the borders. But some of the particularly Douglas fir and Pinus contorta are very strong spreaders, and so a one wilding up on a slope can spread their seed a long way across the landscape and establish. And so what the government and the Wilding Pine Network have been doing is controlling and trying to eradicate these conifers from the landscape, and particularly with focusing on the more risk-prone areas where the wind flow will promote and understanding where those seed sources are and taking out those seed sources, and that will help reduce the spread and allow them to get on top of it more easily. And so there was significant investment through the years in controlling and removing these seed sources and taking out these wildings. What you do is once you remove the wildings, you're going to get the seed that's already in the environment popping up again. And you have about 3 to 4 years before some of the species begin to cone and begin to seed again. And so if you remove them, if you don't come back and do follow-up treatments to remove the next generation and the next generation, you're going to just allow the problem to continue. Eventually, with continued maintenance, you can see that you will eliminate the issue. So there has been a period of what's called deferred maintenance, and that's where the maintenance or the follow-up work that needs to be done has been deferred, and it doesn't need to be done that first year, and it doesn't need to be done the next year, but then the third and subsequent years, any time that you don't go back in and do follow-up treatment, you're going to allow the initial investment of time and money and effort to potentially go to waste. And so that's where this extra money is really valued, and allowing the network to be able to deliver the deferred maintenance that's been deferred for years. I personally don't know how much of an impact the current investment will make, but I would hope it will be substantial.
Right, so what are the approaches that we're generally taking to curb wilding pine populations? I mean, if we go to get a Christmas tree, you typically chop it down with an axe or a saw. I mean, are we taking that approach for wilding pines, or are there herbicides that we are using from, like, helicopters, for example? What's the approach that we take?
So there's multiple methods that are employed, and there's community groups that will go up and actively chop down wildings, and are very successful in certain areas, and other methods as well as chopping and felling, drilling and filling. So you drill a hole in the tree, and you put in herbicide into the tree, and that will kill it. And then there's a helicopter spray operations, and it depends on the scale of the problem. If you're dealing with a large forest or, you know, like contiguous sort of area of wildings, then a broadcast, so a spray treatment right across the top of them is effective. It's quite a toxic herbicide brew, in that it's going to kill a wilding, it's going to kill other species that will, you know, plant species that will likely come in contact with. Some species might be a bit more resistant, but it's obviously you want to target it as best you can.
Is that one used maybe a bit more as like a last resort, or?
Yes, it is. But it is also something that can operate it, that can do it at scales you're really dealing with. So I guess you consider it a necessary evil. If you don't use those methods, then the time it will take for a crew to manually go through is just, you know, years, and you're not going to keep on top of things. So you do need to use these techniques. For a more dispersed wilding, you wouldn't employ a broadcast method. You want to do sort of spot spraying, and so helicopters will either go around and spray, just the little patch of wilding or a particular or one tree, sometimes they use a it's called ABBA, aerial basal bark application, and they'll spray a jet of herbicide onto the trunk and have it run down, and that effectively chemically ring barks the tree and kills it. And then new technologies such as uncrewed aerial spray systems, the drone spraying, something's called. Those are coming in, and they're becoming a lot more capable. And so they will potentially displace manned helicopter missions and really make that sort of spot spraying and that sort of control a lot more effective and efficient and cost effective. These are all methods that are being employed, and then some of the other methods, which back in the day, and they're sort of considering for large forests, is actually burning. Burning can obviously, you know, if it gets up to a high enough temperature, will also kill some of the regeneration of the trees. But of course, you know, it comes with all the other challenges of dealing with fire and managing the smoke and everything. And then finally, the sort of idea that if you are grazing land, if it's coming into farmland, for instance, obviously grazing's going to be a method of preventing the regeneration coming through, because the sheep or the livestock will crush or eat the young seedlings. Once it's established, they won't eat it. But the issue with grazing is if you're trying to put it into an indigenous or native landscape, then the grazing is just going to be just as damaging as the trees. So that's potentially not a method for controlling regrowth in those regions.
Right, well, with any luck, that funding boost will hopefully deliver some reductions in the number of wilding pines we see. But thank you very much, Dr. Justin Nairn, for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks very much.
That was Dr. Justin Nairn, a plant protection scientist at Scion and the New Zealand Institute for Bioeconomy Science, about the government's recent funding boost for wilding pine control.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa, pardon me, mo tenei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e koro mai ki mātou mo tenei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests. The Green Party is Ricardo Menendez-March, senior lecturer in US history at the University of Auckland, Dr. Paul Tayon, Miles Thomas from the Better Public Media Trust, and Dr. Justin Nunn from SCIAN and the New Zealand Institute of Bioeconomy Science. Nei rā hoki, te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to The Wire. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Bridge. See you next week.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.